Let's begin another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening to Job chapter number 27. Now remember, this book is classified in our modern English Bibles as wisdom literature. The Jewish people looked at it as a prophetic book, a book about a prophet, kind of something like the book of Jonah. And so the prophet Job is being slammed by Satan. We know that from chapters 1 and 2. Job doesn't know that. Neither does anyone else that's in the book itself. So we need to keep that in mind through the entire story. Now, the prophet Job, he's very upset because of all the bad things that have happened to him. He's assuming from bad information that God's the one that's doing it. It is true that God is allowing it, but he is not actively doing these things to Job. So Job, in his emotion, in his assumption, says a few things that are kind of borderline, that kind of push the limits. But when we get to the end of the book, where God himself is doing the talking, it is clear that Job never crossed the line. Job never did anything that should be counted as sin. The same cannot be true for his supposed friends. And that is why I always remind you, you have to be careful about everything you're reading in this book. Some of it is assumptions by Job. Others are the assumptions and the philosophy of his buddies. And one of the big philosophies of his buddies is bad things only happen to bad people. And therefore, they believe Job has been a secret sinner. That's why these bad things are happening. And he needs to repent so that he can get back into good things happening from God. And Job is quite frustrated with them because he knows in his heart of hearts he hasn't done anything wrong. So he's been pushing back against them, but he's also been reaching out toward God saying, "Why? Why are you doing these things to me? If you'd only just come down here and give me a chance, I'd lay all the evidence out, and then we could come to an understanding that I didn't do anything wrong, and you'd answer me and tell me why these bad things are happening." So that's where we're at. Job is now ready to say some more things in the midst of that context. So Job 27, verse number 1. And again, let me remind you, let yourself feel the emotion of Job here. The book of Job is much like a lot of the Psalms. You have to feel it to really appreciate it. So Job 27, verse 1. Job again took up his discourse and said, "As God lives, who has taken away my right." Now, again, that's the assumption he's making, is that God is the one that's taken away all this stuff from him and taken away his health. "And the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me, and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils." So he's talking about as long as I'm alive, as long as I continue breathing. Listen to what he says, verse 4. "My lips will not speak falsehood, and my tongue will not utter deceit." So his supposed friends, his acquaintances, his business buddies perhaps, they've actually been accusing him of engaging in sinful behavior. And he has defended himself against that. So here he is again saying, "I'm telling you, no matter what God does to me," that's the assumption, "I am not going to sin against God's holiness, his righteousness. He doesn't want me to speak lies, so I'm not going to speak lies." Verse 5, Far be it from me to say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. So, no, I am not going to confess my sin because I haven't done any sin. Verse 6, I will hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. So he is making it very clear to his acquaintances here that he hasn't done anything wrong, and no matter how much pressure philosophically they put on him, he can't confess something he hasn't done. Verse 7, let my enemy be as the wicked. Let him who rises up against me be as the unrighteous. Now, this sounds a little imprecatory. When we get to the book of Psalms much later, we will have this classification of psalm called the imprecatory psalm. And it's just a fancy word for put the curse on him psalm. It's where David or others are so upset and so frustrated with the misbehaviors of other people that they say, God, sick 'em, get 'em, take 'em down, because of their unrighteousness. And so here is Job talking about people acting as his enemies, rising up against them, and he wants them to be taken down a notch or two. He wants judgment to come on them. Now, who in the world might he be talking about? Well, of course, he has in mind these accusatory men in his presence. Verse 8, for what is the hope of the godless when God cuts him off? When God takes away his life? So when judgment comes on you from God, there is no hope. If you have not repented and he comes down hard on you, you are, as many of us would say today, toast. You're done. When God, will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? If he's begging for these bad things to stop happening to him, but he's not repenting, is God going to listen to that? Will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call upon God at all times? I'm quite well aware that there are some people, when bad things happen to them, they would rather curse a God than ask for him to help. They would rather deny that there is a God than to possibly seek his assistance. And that seems to be what Job has in mind here, is that type of mindset. Verse 11, I will teach you concerning the hand of God what is with the Almighty. I will not conceal. Behold, all of you have seen it yourselves. Why then have you become altogether vain? So he says, you guys know better than to make these accusations that God is punishing me while he's not punishing other people that are clearly sinners. Verse 13 now, this is the portion of the wicked with God and the heritage that oppressors receive from the Almighty. So now he's going to give a little description of some of the potential ways that the judgment of God might be seen in the lives of bad people, genuinely bad people. And this is very generic, and it fits up there with the idea that God said in his introduction to Moses about himself that while he is gracious and merciful and forgiving and kind, he will also not allow sinners to continually get away with their sin. And the way he expresses it there in the book of Exodus is that he will visit the sins of the fathers upon their children to the third and fourth generation. Now, that causes a little confusion for some people because they think that means God punishes the kids for what their parents did or their grandparents did. But that is not the context. The context is God punishes the sins of individuals, and those consequences will reverberate into the next few generations. So if God punishes someone, that's going to impact on their kid and often on their grandkid. So we see exactly that family connection here. Verse 14, if his children are multiplied, so he has lots and lots of kids in his sin, it's for the sword. So they end up themselves being attacked because of their dad's misbehaviors. Because God causes circumstances to go against the guy, and that impacts on his family. His descendants will not have enough bread. Those who survive him, but the pestilence buries, and his widows do not weep. So they're kind of happy that he's gone on, because maybe they're thinking he's the one that's brought this on the family. Though he heap up silver like dust and pile up clothing like clay. Now, the clothing confuses us in our modern context. Clothing was actually a wealth item in the ancient world. They were so well made and made out of very expensive material that they were cared for and cherished and passed on as items of inheritance. So what he's saying here is, it doesn't matter how much wealth he lays aside in silver and in clothing, verse 17, he may pile it up, but the righteous will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver, because the bad guy will eventually pass from the scene, perhaps at the direct judgment of God, and other people end up with their stuff. So he builds his house like a moth's. Think of a moth as having this cocoon that it made. It used to be a little caterpillar, and then it made a little cocoon, and then it popped out and it became the moth. And what about that cocoon? It's just junk, right? So he builds his house like a moth's house, like a booth that a watchman makes. I'm talking about here a guy that's out taking care of the sheep, and it's kind of sunny on the hillside. So he makes himself a little lean-to to get out of the sun. Well, that's not very permanent, is it? So that's what happens to this guy's house. His physical things are just temporary. So he goes to bed rich, but will do so no more. So his wealth disappears overnight. He opens his eyes and his wealth is gone. Terrors overtake him like a flood. In the night, a whirlwind carries him off. So we got storms and tornadoes. And some of that is reminiscent of what happened to Job's family members. But here he's thinking that just bad things suddenly come into this guy's life at God's direction, or we might say permission, and that's used as judgment against him. Verse 21, the east wind lifts him up and he's gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls at him without pity. He flees from its power in headlong flight. It claps its hands at him and hisses at him from its place. In ancient times, apparently, clapping your hands at somebody was a bad thing. It was not a matter of applause. It was more like that, stop that! Don't be like that! That sort of thing that we might do to our pets or our kids or our grandkids. Or hiss. Hiss was definitely a bad thing. And so that's how he pictures genuine judgment from God against genuine bad guys. Now, chapter 28. I really find this extended description fascinating. Chapter 28, surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold that they refine. Now, we know that mining is one of the ways you get the ores that have silver or gold in it, and then you have to process that ore in order to get the precious metal out of it. Well, they used to have those all over the place. Verse 2, iron is taken out of the earth, copper is smelted from the ore. So Job seems to be fairly familiar with some mining operations and some processing of that ore into the different precious metals. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out the farthest limit, the ore, in gloom and deep darkness. Now, this almost sounds like he's experienced what it's like being down inside a mine where lights have to be carried into the shafts and into the tunnels so that the work can be done. Verse 4, he opens shafts in a valley away from where anyone lives. So it's out in the middle of nowhere. They are forgotten by travelers. So these mines are in out-of-the-way places. They hang in the air far away from mankind. They swing to and fro. Now, that might be confusing unless you think about those little lamps that you're going to need to put an end to the darkness down there in the deep mine shafts, in the deep mine, lanes where they're doing all the digging. So you bring that lantern and you put it up on some sort of cable across the shaft. And so there they are, just kind of swinging back and forth. As for the earth, out of it comes bread, but underneath it, it is turned up as by fire. So up on the top, you got grain fields. But down here, down deep, there is material that's been brought into existence by the fires of earth. Its stones are the place of sapphires, and it has dust of gold. So it's not just precious metals. There's also precious stones down in these mines. Man puts his hand, verse 7, I skipped. That path no bird of prey knows. The falcon's eye has not seen it. The proud beasts have not trodden it. The lion has not passed over it. So you don't have birds that fly over the landscape down inside the mine. They don't know it's even there. Same thing with the lions. They're stalking in the forest up above. Don't have a clue that there's people digging down below. Man puts his hand to the flinty rock and overturns mountains by the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up streams so that they do not trickle, and the thing that is hidden he brings to light. Now, he can actually do that to above-ground streams, but it seems as if everything in this passage is about stuff going on underneath the earth, down inside of those mine shafts, those mine tunnels. And in some of those places, they have underground streams. They have underground rivers. And so what do these miners do? They dam them up so that they can find things underneath that underground water. Now, what was the whole point of all that? Verse 12. But where shall wisdom be found? So that's the whole thing he was getting to. Men have made mine shafts and discovered lots of things hidden underground, deep underground where nobody would ever have imagined that they were. But what about wisdom? Where is mankind supposed to find wisdom? Where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. So man does not appreciate just how important wisdom really is. So the deep says, well, it's not me. And the sea says, it's not with me. So as mankind is searching out wisdom, the environment is portrayed as saying, no wisdom here. It cannot be bought for gold, and silver cannot be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir. Now, Ophir seems to be a place where we'd call it northeast Saudi Arabia is today. Maybe a little bit of Kuwait, somewhere in that region. So it was a place known to have good gold. So it can't be valued in the best of gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold and glass cannot equal it. The glass here is probably a reference to some sort of crystal. Nor can it be exchanged for jewels of fine gold. No mention should even be made of coral or of crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. So wisdom is beyond human estimated price. That's what he says. From where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It's hidden from the eyes of all living. It's concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon, which is the place of punishment of wicked spirits. And death, the place where, in this case, dead spirits of humanity are living. Abaddon and death both say, I think we've heard a rumor of it with our ears. So they're like, yeah, it's not here, but we've heard of it. And then he gets to his point. God understands the way of it. He knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth, and he sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the wind its weight, think about barometric pressure, how wind can kind of count as some sort of weight for us. When he gave the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, so we're talking about creation. When he made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder, so nature. Then he saw it, and he declared it. He established it and searched it out. So even though wisdom cannot be geolocated, even though wisdom can't be bought because it's beyond value, God can provide it. Verse 28, he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. That's pretty much the theme verse, the theme phrase in the book of Proverbs later. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, genuine wisdom. And what's the distinction between knowledge and wisdom? Well, wisdom is knowing what to do with all that information, how to use it properly. And God is the source of that wisdom. And the only way that you can receive it from God is by having a healthy respect for Him and doing what His wisdom says. Now, the parallelism says, and to turn away from evil is understanding. Fear of the Lord is the same thing as turning away from evil. Not doing the wrong thing. And understanding, genuine understanding, is parallel with wisdom. You want to know how to think and act? Well, go to God's book. Find out what it is that God wants you to know and to do. Chapter 29, we'll get started on before we run out of time today. Job again took up his discourse, and he said, "Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me." So now he's back to wishing he was back before all this trouble started. And when he says months of old, that gives, I think, some sense that it's not been terribly long since this whole thing started. I've suggested it might have happened the previous year. So here he's saying, you know, in months past, that's where I wished I was again. Verse 3, when his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness. So he wishes he was back when God clearly was guiding him. As I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were all around me. So this is back before his kids got killed. And then some poetic things that I'll have to come back and explain next time. But it says, when my steps were washed with butter, and the rock poured out for me streams of oil. Mark your spot. We'll get back into the Word next time.